So last week I began what I sometimes do, which is a two-part series, and I like to reassure you if you weren't here last week, it's fine, you'll catch on. Its title was Awakening from the Trance, and I spent some time last week really focusing on how many moments we are lost in that cocoon of our thoughts. And as I described it, one person said we have, you know, something like 80,000 thoughts a day, and 95% of them we had yesterday. So there's a sense that we really, it's not interesting stuff usually, it's just blather. So I described some of how we get caught and some of the practices that help us to wake up out of conceptual thinking, and noted that it's really challenging because the conditioning is so huge, not only to think a lot, but be lost in it and be addicted to thinking, that we feel off if we're not figuring things out all the time. And it happens in daily life. It happens around the small stuff. It happens around the big stuff. I mean, in spiritual life, figuring out where we are on the map and what we need to do. And some of you might remember one of my favorite Zen stories of this student that goes to his Roshi and says, "Well, Master, what happens after we die?" And the master looks at him and says, "I don't know." And then the student's really frustrated. He said, "I thought you were a Zen monk." And the response, "I am, but not a dead one," you know. I love the way Joseph Campbell says that religion covers over the mystery. That all the ideas and cosmologies, doesn't mean they can't be skillful at times, but in a basic way, if we're hooked on trying to figure it out or our ideas about how things are, that in the moment of conceptualizing, we are removed from that immediate, visceral experience of the mystery. So I'd like to talk really about how meditation is a path of discovery. And I like the word discovery. Looked it up right before I came. To gain sight or knowledge of something previously unseen or unknown. So what that means is when we're discovering, we're not discovering something new. We're kind of uncovering or rediscovering what's always and already here. And we do it in part by discovering, by taking off the cover of thought forms, stepping beyond them. Now, in a way, I think of it that we're living in this very highly programmed, computer-generated virtual reality a whole lot of the time. A whole lot of the time. We're just on this. It's very automatic and reflexive and repetitive. And that doesn't mean that there isn't a huge amount of really creative, valuable thinking that goes on. And I sometimes am amused because when I put together talks on awakening from conceptual mind, I put a whole lot of thinking into them. And sometimes the longest talks I have are about not thinking, you know, like tons of words. But I actually, it's one of the Dharma talks I offer a lot, and at the longer retreats in particular, because in my own practice, it's by quieting the mind that all the real discovery happens. It doesn't mean that thoughts aren't skillful. It just means the radical awakening, the seeing what's really right here, the realizing what we are, the awareness and presence that's here is bigger than any thought can imagine. It's not that hard to see how thinking gets us in trouble. Much of our thinking is fear-based. I learned recently that we wake up 10 times every night, at an average, and scan our environment to see what might be wrong and then go back to sleep. And usually it's so quick that we don't remember it. And that was very useful because for most of human existence, we were subject to predators that we really needed to scan for. But in the last hundreds of thousands of years, it's not as useful to wake up and scan. And for many of us, we wake up and then we don't go back to sleep. And we know that one too. And that our reflexes were primed to see what's off. We're primed to see what can go wrong. A linguistics professor was lecturing to his class one day. In English, he said, a double negative forms a positive. In some languages, though, such as Russian, a double negative is still a negative. However, there is no language wherein a double positive can form a negative. A voice from the back of the room piped up, yeah, right. So what happens? We scan for what's wrong. We have some underlying beliefs that fear-based beliefs that something's wrong with me or you or the world. And they're very deep and they're very core. And then they proliferate into these beliefs, into they bring up fear in our body. And then that fear in our body creates behaviors and more thoughts that are fear-based. And it keeps cycling. So we live in a kind of mental, physical, you know, biochemical cocktail of fear to some level. Most of the time, we're in that wash of fear. And that as long as we're believing our beliefs, our thoughts, it keeps on getting perpetuated. I read last week a verse from Gandhi, and I want to bring it back in here tonight because I think it really says it. Your beliefs become your thoughts. Your thoughts become your words. Your words become your actions. Your actions become your habits. Your habits become your character. Your character becomes your destiny. So there is an imprisoning that happens when we run thoughts or beliefs that are based on an idea of a separate self that's in some way bad, unworthy, or others that are bad or unworthy, creates a certain mood that then creates actions, and it really becomes our temperament. Our body's armored in certain ways, our heart gets armored, and then we find that in our life we live these patterns where we wonder why at age 50, we're having the same things happen as age 18 in our relationships. It becomes our character. Even when our thoughts are not negative, even when we're not perpetuating on the level of the outright dukkha or suffering, any time we're living in our ideas or stories, we're disconnected from our senses. When we're in thought forms, our senses close down some. We're not aware of the space of sound. And we're not aware, as you might not have been this moment, of the aliveness in the body or of the breath. So our thoughts cover over the mystery of here-ness. Which is what we are. We are here-ness. We lose sight of what we are. So much of our practice is to reconnect with that sense of wholeness, not to vanquish thoughts, but to have the capacity to notice them and come back to that presence that is really the source of loving and real creativity and real freedom. This is Rumi. Be empty of worrying. Think of who created thought. Why do you stay in prison when the door is so wide open? Move outside the tangle of fear thinking. Live in silence. Flow down and down in always widening rings of being. move outside the tangle of fear thinking. Live in silence. Flow down and down in always widening rings of being. We get glimmers. We wouldn't be here if we hadn't tasted the quietness that really is the source of our life, the silence that's listening right now to these words, or the stillness that's the source of all activity. We've all had glimmers in these moments or these pauses where we've just sensed awe or wonder, or where we stopped our busyness and really opened our hearts fully to the life within or with someone else. So we get these glimmers of openness and presence. And then what happens, there's this kind of habit or movement of selfing, where the self kind of reincarnates. Like we might be quiet and open, but something happens and there's maybe a little deep uneasiness and we recontract. And then the thoughts start coming. And it's basically the self is recreating itself. It's asserting its existence, which is what the self tries to do. It just wants to exist. It's something like a birthday candle that won't go out, you know. You know, it goes out, but it comes again. And one person gave this description of, you know, we kind of come to rest and there's that openness and presence. And then this self recoagulates and it's almost like a mummy coming out of a vault, kind of stumbling around, half conscious, doing its thinking and acting and moving like a robotic self. We kind of go back into our habitualness. Many of us know it with our daily practice, that we'll sit and quiet down and have a half hour, maybe come out of it and feel pretty present and move slowly a bit, maybe even as far as getting our cup of tea or whatever. And how long until we're kind of like speeding around and doing and driving and worrying, and it's just like we just lock back in. It's that mummy stumbling around half conscious, you know. And that's the suffering, which is that we forget when we're in the daily trance. We forget really that vastness, that luminosity of presence, that silence that's listening. We forget. So there is this tenaciousness, and when we begin to practice, we're challenging it a bit. When we begin to practice here, what we're doing is saying, okay, I'm going to be here. I'm not going to follow the doings. I'm not going to go down the train of thoughts. And what happens? What happens when, rather than following thoughts, we have that intention for here-ness? What do we notice? We might arrive a bit, but we're off again pretty quickly, right? It doesn't last long. So there's this real compellingness to being with thoughts. And how come? The false self feels more in control when it's thinking. It's like it wants to be vigilant, it wants to be scanning, it wants to be figuring. We want a map. We have a sense of I'm here now, but tonight after class I'm doing this, and we know exactly what's coming up on Friday and Saturday. And we place our existence on a timeline that's mental. What happens when we stop thinking? That all becomes kind of groundless, and there's an uneasiness. We really hold tight to our ideas, our mental control tower. Somebody sent me this a while ago. Three older ladies were discussing the travails of getting older. One said, you know, sometimes I catch myself with a jar of mayonnaise in my hand in front of the refrigerator. I can't remember whether I need to put it away or start making a sandwich. The second chimed in, yeah, sometimes I find myself on the landing of the stairs and can't remember whether I was on my way up or on my way down. The third one responded, well, I'm awfully glad I don't have that problem, knock on wood, as she rapped her knuckles on the table and said, oh, that must be the door. I'll go get it. So So we play with it, and there's more and more, you know, jokes about what, you know, so many of us here, moi, you know, how hard it is to retrieve certain things. And there's huge, huge fear about losing the map, losing this instrument of mental control. And it's about survival. So there's a reason that when we have the intention to wake up out of thoughts, we get very uneasy, and that there's a very quick latching back on. It's to reassert our sense of a separate self and find safety. We're trying to find safety. In an evolutionary sense, we're meant to think, we're meant to try to find safety, and that's not the end of the evolutionary story. We're also meant to wake up to that presence that's bigger than thinking and discover what we are. So it's not easy because we're kind of hooked at a certain phase of our development. And yet there's a lot of suffering if we don't keep waking up. So this is really the example of the Buddha, where he sat under the Bodhi tree and just committed to waking up from the trance of thoughts. And it's not easy, but he just sat there and did that, and he looked into his own mind and discovered the freedom that was there. Quieted down, paused, arrived right here. So this is the practice of meditation. We quiet the mind and we discover, uncover, reconnect with what's here. So I want to explore a bit more of how that really happens and what we discover, and do it by sharing a story with you. This is a story from Scandinavia. It's about Princess R and the serpent. The princess's parents had fallen on hard times, dicey financial trouble. Raise some money from the dragon's hoard was the idea. That they, you know, had the dragon agree to give them some money, help them out, and he asked a small thing in return, their daughter. You've heard these stories before. So the parents went to the princess and said, "Dear, we've decided on the proper betrothal for you, and you're going to be married to the dragon." But she was a resourceful princess, and although she was frightened and tearful, she went immediately to the village wise woman who lived at the edge of the marketplace. And found her surrounded by her dozen or two children and grandchildren, and poured out her story. And the wise woman asked her, "Do you want to marry this dragon?" "Well, absolutely not." And she said, "Well, I think there's a way for you to do it that will be safe. And here's what you have to do on your wedding night." And then she whispered a while in her ear and sent her home. The first thing that she was told she had to do was get a number of wedding grounds, 10 in fact. The wedding day came. All the people came to the court. It was a big celebration. It was a little tough, but it was finished, and they retired to the bridal chambers. The dragon turned to the princess and said, "Well, isn't it time to consummate our wedding, my dear?" And the princess responded, "Yes, oh dear husband, but for me to do so, I must remove my wedding gowns. Is that not so?" "Absolutely, my dear, joyfully." She said, "Then I would ask as a small favor from you in return. Since I must remove my gowns to be pleasing to you, would you not remove a layer of your own so you could be pleasing to me?" So she took off a wedding gown, and he had worn a few decorative things on his dragon body, and he took them off. Okay, fine. But to his surprise, he noticed she had another wedding gown on, the second of 10. She took that one off. And dragons are so used to taking off their scales, like reptiles have to shed some once in a while. He peeled off a thin layer, said, "Yes, dear." Whoops, she had another. And as she took off each layer of wedding gowns, 4, 5, 6, the dragon's claws had to dig deeper and deeper into his own flesh and skin to peel off yet another layer. And on the 8th wedding gown she took off, the dragon was down to taking off parts of himself that were stuck. And his form began to change. And on the 9th, it changed more remarkably. And when she took off the 10th gown, by that time, the dragon had pulled off so much dragonness that what was left, as is often true in these stories, was a handsome prince. And then she took the advice of the old woman from far beyond the marketplace that had a dozen children or so and grandchildren and had a night of wedded bliss. So, this practice of meditation, we feel these layers. What happens is as we get quiet, we encounter layers of our being. We encounter kind of a scaling where all the fear and the wanting is coagulated, the thoughts, the behaviors. And bit by bit, as we deepen our attention, we begin to release some of the identification with those scales, with the armor, with the habitual thoughts. More and more, rather than believing them, we just see them. So it's not like we're actually taking off a scale, but we're dissolving the identification that really keeps us stuck in a sense of separateness. And as we do that, as there's this kind of releasing of the layers, what we discover, and it's a discovery of what's already here, what we discover is the radiance and beauty of our own spirit, of what we really are. So this is the invitation, that we more and more learn to pause rather than rolling forward into our thoughts and our behaviors. Learn to pause and arrive in that here-ness that begins to loosen the scales. It's in being right here that we start dissolving that identification with a small and unworthy self. It's in being right here that we discover that presence that's shining, that heart that's open. Every spiritual tradition that I know of has its methods for loosening the scaliness. Every mystical tradition for loosening the grip of thinking and the doing self. And it can be chanting that just really opens us out of that sense of an ego self, or it might be prayer. For some, the Zen koans disrupt habitual thinking. The Tibetan lamas have a way of kind of cutting through the conditioning of habitual thought, where sometimes they'll go out on the great plateaus. There's a big open sky in Tibet, and they'll just jump around and shriek and laugh and roll and play. It's like they'll do anything to like wake up out of the humdrum cocoon of thought. Now I have an example from our Western culture of how sometimes we try to destabilize or undo that, which is a little strange. It says, there's a few suggestions. It's a list of how to disrupt your habitual way. Every time someone asks you to do something, ask them if they want fries with that. Put decaf in the coffee maker for 3 weeks. Once everyone's gotten over their caffeine addiction, switch to espresso. In the memo field of all your checks, write for sexual favors. Finish all your sentences with, in accordance with the prophecy. Specify always that your drive-through order is to go. And then let's see. When leaving the zoo, start running towards the parking lot yelling, run for your lives, they're loose. Just one more. When the money comes out of the ATM, scream, I won, third time this week, I won. Anyway, whatever we can to like not be in that habitual mode. So how does meditation do it? Okay, just to slow it down a little. How do we practice in a way that wakes us up from habitual thinking and really reveals what we are? And I sometimes think of it as three levels, and that the first level is a level of arriving. And we have to arrive again and again because we just go off in trance. And that's okay. It's an effort that's a very light effort because we're really making the effort to be here. It's kind of a relaxing back into this, right here. I sometimes call it remindfulness. It's a remembering, a reconnecting with what's here. And so what supports remindfulness is to really wake up our senses. I started tonight, I did a lot with listening. Listening is a very powerful way to connect with our natural awareness, because there's a receptivity in listening. There's very little doing. You don't go after a sound. When there's real listening, a kind of global, just listening, we've re-established that openness and presence that is home. We are the quiet or the silence that's listening. So that's a beautiful pathway through our senses back to our naturalness, this receptive listening attention. So we get familiar with the senses being awake, that we listen to sound, and then we feel the aliveness in our bodies. Take a moment and sense what you might not have been connected with. Just to breathe, maybe close your eyes and just feel the aliveness here. Listening to sound, feeling the body. Just listen to the sound of the bell and let yourself be here. With the senses wide open, notice the difference between any thought, any memory or planning, and the vividness, the vitality of here-ness, of being here. So the beginning of our practice is this arriving, and it doesn't matter how many times we notice we've been gone and we arrive, we start creating a kind of natural pathway home. We're learning our way home. Awareness wants to be aware of itself. And the way that it expresses that want is through an interest. What's really here? What am I? Who's listening right now? So even though we have a lot of conditioning to leave, to go off into thoughts, there's a very deep draw, says all moving is from the mover, that this essence awareness wants to realize itself through these forms, and our pathway is through here-ness, presence. So you can open your eyes when you'd like, but this is the beginning that we over and over again, this remindfulness, and we do it. What motivates us? We, more than we want to be off in the trance, we want to be at home with what's true. Doesn't mean we won't get lost many rounds, but there's something in us that wants to come home to presence, that wants to discover what's true. So then what happens? We encounter layers that are really difficult. We encounter what we've been running away from. We encounter all the layers of the fears and the clinging and the loneliness. And there's a restlessness. If you start really coming right here, you can sense it. There's a real unease. So then the practice is, how do we learn to stay with what's here, even though it's difficult? And a lot of the skills that we explore here are are ways to begin to really bring a tremendous compassion and clarity to these layers that unfold themselves. It's like awareness wants everything included and untangled and free. And so anything that's been tangled and excluded starts revealing itself in this space of presence. It's not like we say, okay, let's be present and then it's all bliss. We have these, just more of life wants to be included. So then there's this practice, and it's gradual, of learning to stay with what arises. To the extent that we keep running away from fear or loneliness, our identity gets solidified around it. It gets locked in. The way that we heal in the moment that there's no resistance, totally no resistance, there's a saying that when the resistance is gone, the demons are gone. Another way to think of it, when the resistance is gone, the trance of identification with what we're resisting starts dissolving. The scales start falling off naturally. Not to resist. So that's the second part. First part, remindfulness, coming here. The second part, opening to what's here with no resistance. Noticing and allowing. The third part is, when it gets quieter, is noticing the awareness itself. Turning the attention to the one that's listening, to the space that's awake. This is Zen Master Dogen. He says, "The human mind has absolute freedom as its true nature. There are thousands upon thousands of students who have practiced meditation and obtained this realization. Do not doubt the possibilities because of the simplicity of the method. If you can't find the truth where you are, where else do you expect to find it?" So the practice is to arrive in this here-ness, in this presence, and really discover the awareness that's aware. And what we discover when we look, when we ask that question, who's listening right now, or who's aware right now, or what's aware, is that we can't find anything. We can come up with a mental answer, but if we really look back into awareness, it's a mystery. What we are is a mystery. And then relaxing into the not knowing, we become that vastness. A story that Rachel Remen, who I've mentioned many times here, told. She's a physician and teacher and writer, really, really wonderful in all those areas. For the last 10 years of his life, Tim's father suffered from early Alzheimer's disease. Despite the devoted care of Tim's mother, he had slowly deteriorated until he had become a sort of walking vegetable. He was unable to speak and was fed, clothed, and cared for as if he were a very young child. One day, Tim and his brother were home with their father while their mother was out shopping. They were watching football as their father sat nearby in a chair. Suddenly, he slumped forward and fell to the floor. Both sons realized immediately that something was terribly wrong. His color was gray and his breath uneven and rasping. Frightened, Tim's older brother told him to call 911. Before he could respond, a voice he had not heard in 10 years, a voice he could barely remember, interrupted. "Don't call 911, Tim. Tell your mother that I love her. Tell her that I am all right." And Tim's father died. So Tim's now a cardiologist, he went on, says, "Because he died unexpectedly at home, the law required that we have an autopsy. My father's brain was almost entirely destroyed by his disease. For many years, I've asked myself, who spoke? Who are we really? I have never found the slightest help from any medical knowledge. Much of life can't be explained. It can only be witnessed. So Tim was confronted with the mystery of consciousness beyond the brain and of the presence that's always here, that's not always seen, not understood mentally, but here. The Tibetans say it's one half breath, split second away. This luminous presence, our naturalness, that's always here. And yet we spend these swaths of our existence off in this trance of thinking, reacting, that kind of mummy bumbling around, and just don't realize what's here. So this is the, again, as I said, the invitation of practice, that we pause more. It's really a training in pausing, just to kind of interrupt the habitualness, that we sense what's happening right here, and that we open to it with no resistance. That's what dissolves that sense of selfness, just no resistance to what's here. So we'll just end together with a brief meditation, if you will. Just come sitting in a way that's comfortable. We'll just walk through these. It's a little arbitrary what I'm calling these three parts, but this kind of way of coming home. And as we do often, take a few full breaths and let your breath help you to be here. Kind of breathe yourself here. And feel that kind of dynamic stillness where your body is still, but you can feel the vibrations and sensations and pulsing, maybe pleasant or unpleasant, but just let it live through you. That you can widen the attention and include sound. Relaxing wide open into the space that's listening. Just become that openness. Listening with your whole body, your whole awareness. Awareness is naturally wakeful. To sense the wakefulness, the knowing quality of awareness, that which knows sound, that knows sensation. Awareness is empty. There's no self-knowing. Just an open space of awareness, a sea of wakefulness. Closer than we imagine, this radiant presence, it's right here. More profound, beyond any thought, It's easier to discover than we think because it's what we are. This wakefulness, this openness, this presence is our nature. And more wondrous than we know, this whole play of life, emptiness dancing. Rumi again. One matter, one energy, one light mind, endlessly emanating all things. One bright turning diamond, one. Ground yourself, strip yourself down to blind, loving silence. Stay there until you see you are gazing at the light with its own ageless eyes. Ground yourself, strip yourself down to blind, loving silence. Stay there until you see you are gazing at the light with its own ageless eyes. Ending with the prayer of loving kindness, that we discover and inhabit the loving presence that is our nature, that all beings everywhere are blessed to realize this truth, to live from it. May there be peace on earth. May there be peace everywhere. May all beings everywhere awaken and be free. Namaste.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.